Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Alchemy of Light broadcast. I am Jamil Graham, and I am your host. And welcome to the fourth of a series that I have affectionately called Jamil Finding Her Voice on Radio. These last four, I have been sharing my voice insights, exploring the medium of radio as a solitary voice. And it was exactly a year ago, Don and I had a conversation and spearheaded this whole venture. So it's been really, really helpful to take the time and find my voice as my voice. And I'm very excited about this show. There have been two things on my mind that I really knew I wanted to talk about in a solo voice. And one of them is facing death. I want to share with you all some insights in the process of accompanying my dear friend Richie to his final breath, and then following that up with accompanying my lovely mother, Juliet Nightingale, to her final breath, and how that has supported me in preparing for these times, these end new beginning times that we're all in. And the other thing I wanted to talk about was creating a world without money. And money has been on my mind a lot this week, watching the looting of what used to be America, just really knowing that the world without money is upon us and realizing the tremendous gift in that. So I was walking this morning and had this incredible understanding of how not only do these themes work together, but I have really good news. There are two awesome shows coming up after this one. We're going to go back to having guests, and I'm so excited because they are the perfect shows to come after Facing Death. And on the 27th of August, I will welcome Sonia Barrett. She is the author of The Holographic Canvas, The Fusing of Mind and Matter. And her work is very, very focused on developing the power within, understanding the human as a program mechanism that our consciousness has the power to get in there and co-create with. And after you face death, you want to know who you are. You really have some questions about who you are. So we will welcome Sonia to follow up our conversation from a more holistic soul perspective. And then on the 10th of September, I'm really excited as well to be welcoming Robert Stanley. He has just released a book, Encounters in Washington, D.C., a follow-up to a book he wrote, Close Encounters on Capitol Hill. What he has been doing in the last 6 years is an in-depth exploration of hundreds of UFO sightings and encounters in Washington, D.C. He is a fresh voice in the movement of developing our healthy, real relationship with beings from other dimensions, beings who are not based here on planet Earth. He is a very inspiring energy to come into this. So I find that extraordinary, along with the fact that he also has uncovered the fact that some extraterrestrial energies, some that work in hand in hand in the DC area, have ulterior motives for the human race. Now, after we face death, find our soul connection, and understand that as soul beings, we have the power in our consciousness to work the holograph, work the holographic canvas to co-create our lives, it's not so hard to understand that an alien, quote, species might actually have power to manipulate the human as a species as well, because the human is just that. It's a species among many species, and it has some pluses and minuses. You know, you could compare them to other species, but the human is basically a species like every other, and its profound capacity is to be programmed. And when you understand the human, the body that we're wearing as what I call a wondrous sensorial mechanism, you understand that it can easily, so easily be hijacked and manipulated by these forces that are off world. You see, we've been spinning our circles around the same story that doesn't work because it's not complete. And that's a very, very basic, very summarized statement. But Robert Stanley will be here on the 10th of September to help clarify that. So this is really exciting the way this is working out. So now I will share my experience of what I'm going to say facing death. Death in our Western culture is basically something we don't like to look at. We choose to ignore it. We have many religious coats to put on it. Mostly it goes in the closet. I also find that the super intellectuals, you know, the really cool spiritual people, they don't do much service for it either. They just say, oh, it's an illusion. Forget it. Yeah, right. Act like it's nothing. And, you know, it is something. It really is something when you are confronted with a situation where an entity that you interacted with in a particular form is no longer there, and then you have the experience of not only seeing their spirit leave, but you watch their body become cold. That's something. That is something that affects you profoundly. And the whole theme of Alchemy of Light broadcast and my blog site, alchemyoflight.org, is to birth humanity into a universal consciousness to help us develop our multidimensional, multisensorial capacity and bring in the new world as co-creators. So facing the transition from the body to spirit is rich with so many lessons that we can apply to our everyday lives. It is very definitely something. Death does happen. It is not a final destination. It is part of the life cycle. Death is always the process of rebirth. So it's really, I found incredibly helpful to face the death, to allow the rebirth. If we do not face the death, the rebirth cannot come through. Suppressing all of the emotions, suppressing the intensity of the experience, acting like it doesn't exist, throwing it in the closet, intellectualizing it to nowhere land, doesn't allow us our full conscious process. Our consciousness is emotional. I'm on this road right now, and I'm constantly exploring and growing, but I am convinced that we are feelers. We feel. We feel before we do anything. We feel before we think. If we feel and then think and then become aware of our thinking, then our soul is engaged. But we feel. We do things because we feel things, not because we think we need to do them. And you can prove that to yourself, you know, from very bodily, you know, mundane bodily functions to, you know, when you get manipulated by TV and you're buying something, you're feeling a manipulation. You are responding to your emotions. So in my thesis that I'm developing, and God bless writers. I don't know about y'all, but man, it seems like we write 100 pages to get one worthy paragraph, but you have to write those 100. So I've been writing a lot. My thesis is based on what I'm calling the heart mind. The heart mind, the heart as intelligence, our emotional body as an intelligence, our sensorial composite as the motivating force for our consciousness. If our emotions are engaged, if our emotions are in check, if our mind, heart and mind, including the intellect, is all working well, our emotions are alive. Our emotions are in tune. We are wanting to feel. We are welcoming feelings all the time because our feelings are what make us know we are alive. We are feeling. So to begin, I have had this experience. I was reminded of this experience. As a child, often this experience happened to me. I would be in the classroom, and all of a sudden, my hand would go up, and my heart would pound a little, and I didn't have a thought in my mind, but my hand would go up, and that meant the teacher was going to call on me, and the teacher did, and then this question would come out, and I didn't know where it came from, and it was sometimes I felt flush, sometimes I get butterfly, but there was always something to say, always something came out, and it made me really uncomfortable. Then as I grew older, I recognized certain things about it, but I was recognizing how this radio show is kind of like that. So certainly I've done my homework, but here we go. Sharing my process with Richie first, and then we'll move to my mother, Juliet Nightingale. And I want to acknowledge both of their beings with us today and thank them for being with me and all of us in this broadcast. Richie and I were close friends for about 10 years. He and I shared a lot of things. We both were sort of the outcasts in the little community that we're part of. Only outcasts in that we, you know, weren't as concerned about doing what everybody else did. He and I both left Boston and came back a few times. We both, you know, saw things different, and we both didn't mind that. So we kind of, you know, found each other comforting in that. We were both definitely pursuing our own path, and we and all of our journeys, you know, wherever he was, wherever I was, we were always in touch with each other. We always knew where each other was, what they were doing, sort of, you know, not like everyday thing, but, you know, at least once a month, every few weeks, we knew how each other was doing. So in November of 2006, he gave me a call after visiting his family. He said, "Jamil, I'm going to need you for this one. Can I come over right now?" And I've said, "Of course." And he proceeded to explain to me that he had just returned from his family. He had blood in his urine. He had been to the doctor out there, the story of the doctor and all of that. And he and I looked at each other, and I knew in that moment he was going to leave. I just knew it. And he said, "Will you stand by me?" And I said, "Of course." So his first trips to Boston revealed the tumor in his kidney, one that was common to smokers. And for the entire time that I had known Richie, he had been telling me he needed to stop smoking and drinking. So one thing about Richie is that he was a very honest person. He was many things, but honest was the top of the list. And this is actually my experience. I'm sharing you with this from soul. I wanted to mention that. So in his soul, he had an immediate realization that he had done this to himself. And he was very open about it. He was very concerned about the role model that he was leaving for the children that he worked with. He was very big into bucket drumming, which was junk percussion. Basically, take anything you can get your hands on that makes a sound and bang on it, and you are a musician. He loved the kids in the ghetto. He had a strong passion for helping them find themselves, believe in themselves. And now he was faced with himself and what he had done to himself, and knowing the end result and knowing that these children were going to be a part of his demise was a very big deal to him. He was very open about that. In the last year and a half of his life, I was profoundly affected by the way he put his life in order. He took incredible care with everything he could Now, he was not perfect. He had a lot of challenges in communication. There were a lot of things he might have done better. There's, you know, I'm not saying he's some saint, but he was definitely sincere, and I was definitely watching from the inside. He was calling people. He was writing letters. He was changing things around. He was doing everything he could possibly do to get his house in order and to do what he could. He talked. He was a big talker. He was telling these kids, look at me. Look at, this is what you do when you don't take care of yourself. You got to take care of yourself. Don't smoke cigarettes. Don't even start. He was adamant about making sure that these kids knew that they didn't have to live like he did, and made a very, very strong impression on them. There was another part in Richie's demise that was very powerful for me on a personal level. And that was that in some of our conversations earlier in our relationship, he was the one actually that told me a lot about the nitty gritty of chemotherapy and the crap in it and all this. And my mother had gone through it, but she didn't like to talk about that. And I don't even bother with allopathic medicine. You'll never find me in a hospital unless I'm dying. And if you put me there, you better hope I die. Let me tell you that. But in any case, he and I spoke about that. And after he educated me about, you know, more of the nitty gritty, we agreed, we made a pact, you know, a buddy pact, that we would never do chemotherapy. And if we ever got cancer, we would just do it a different way. We were really clear about that. We made a pact. Okay. Now, we are both very honest people. So a pact between two honest people, that's a big deal. So after the surgery and the tumor was removed with his entire kidney, his oncologist said, oh, well, you've got cancer. Now, we'll skip all of the, all of Jamil's challenges with the oncologist. That we'll save for another time. But in a nutshell, I questioned him and his pretty assistant, and I wanted more proof. And Richie went for it, foot, line, and sinker. He went for it, and he heard this doctor, you know, professional, they call these people, tell him that if he didn't do chemotherapy, he was gonna die. Quote. And I didn't actually hear the oncologist say this, but what it did to Richie was certainly put him in the fast lane to go now. There was another part that I became quite enlightened about, and that was meeting his biological family and the tight sort of controlling bonds and things. The whole, you know how biological families can be, you know, they sometimes you feel like your life isn't your own, but he was very much a part of this, and this was his business. This was his thing. So it was also under pressure from his biological family, being that, you know, we've been brainwashed that chemotherapy is actually a good medicine, when, you know, it's becoming much more apparent that it is not. And we will see this all come out in the next, I give it 5-10 years. It's just coming up to the surface big time that chemotherapy is a killer. It is not something that you need to do to heal yourself, but it is extremely efficient if you want to leave the planet. And this is what Richie wanted to do. In his soul, he wanted to leave the planet. And I knew he was complete. I could see clearly as we were moving into this that he had finished his hand, that there were no more options he felt he could pursue in a way that would honor the dignity of his being. And this really was very intense for me to experience, because he went ahead with the chemotherapy, and I did go with him a few times, but I was always antagonistic in a loving way. I was always affectionately trying to, you know, suggest other things. For instance, often when we would be going down to the floor, you know, the big floor where all the needles and all that are, I say, why don't we just go to the beach? You know, let's go to the beach. And I was as lighthearted as I could, but I really we had a pact. We weren't going to do that. He wasn't going to do that. And I had to learn in that moment, in that process, to love him unconditionally. This was the process that he chose. And he gave me a huge opportunity to love him unconditionally. You know, yes, quote, he broke the pact, quote, but at the same time, he was honoring the path of his soul. And the, of course, the chemo wore out, then they radiated him, and it was really time for him to go. What happened in the end of his life? We'll fast forward, because the last few days of his life were so moving that to this day, I am powerfully inspired by the things that I witnessed in those last days. Now, given his biological family, they're, you know, thing going on, and I was his closest friend. So his sister and I sometimes butted heads. And at the last of the, those in that last week of Richie's life, his sister came to me, and we basically made a deal. We were going to be friends. We were going to work this out. We were going to have a healing experience. And she really gave me the respect that I earned and let me be there for Richie, and she consulted me about Richie. She and I formed the team to be there with Richie by his side for those last days. And that really meant a lot to me, to be brought in and to be trusted on that level. I mean, she and I had all of those conversations. She and I visited the hospice. She and I talked about the morphine. She and I stayed up all night with him. She and I got over all of our shit and really stayed the course to be there for the person we loved. And that was incredible for both of us. I know it was a very powerful experience for her as well. And whew, that was a big deal. Then something else happened that was incredible. There was always a challenge with him and his father, and, you know, a lot of history of gruffness or whatever, a lot of tension in that relationship. I'm not going to go into his story, but he had a lot of issues with his father, never feeling seen or loved by his father, and on other things. So what happened in the last days, his father came out to visit, which was very frightening to Richie. Very frightening. He was very uncomfortable about that. So the short version of the incredibly beautiful story is, an hour after his entire, you know, biological family, save his sister, arrived, we heard Richie was, like I said, really committed to working with children and really committed to junk percussion and doing percussion with kids. He was part of a community organization called Spontaneous Celebrations. And every year they have a festival called Wake Up the Earth. And there's always a parade that walks to the festival. And Richie was always in the festival, always walked in the parade, and always would sit and drum throughout the whole festival. So Richie went down exactly 2 weeks before the festival. So he was not going to be in the parade. In fact, he left his body 6 days before the festival. So in that last week, they knew that he was going down. So they had backup, and they had been working with the kids without him. They were already a team at Spontaneous Celebrations. And right after his biological family arrived, the kids did a rehearsal, and they paraded to his house where he was convalescing on the first floor. And they brought the drums and the songs and the streamers. There were stilt walkers. Every single child came to the window and waved goodbye to him while they were drumming and singing, and while his father was present. And the healing that happened between he and his father as a result of that was such a gift to witness. The power of love cannot be misunderstood. It cannot even be imagined. The power of love that those kids brought in that room and the healing that it brought to the most difficult relationship to him in his life. And that when he did leave, he left with a smile on his face. And at the time that he was preparing to leave, he and I were very telepathic at that point. He could not speak. And when we were in the room, I witnessed his spirit leave his body. And it was beautiful. It was really beautiful. It was a direct stream, looked like smoky fog. It went straight up out of his head. It covered the ceiling of the room, and it swirled. And at the moment, it seemed to all gather itself at the ceiling of the room. It spread out at once all over the universe, and he was gone. And then his sister, who was not with us, confirmed that in Bloomington, in Indiana, where he's from. And wow. So he really gave me a lot of courage to be in that whole situation with an open mind and an open heart. He taught me a lot about unconditional love. He taught me, I learned so much about getting over my ego, working with his family, working, you know, understanding that there is a higher cause here. It was the constant reminder of the higher cause. Look, are we going to sit here and quibble about this? Are we going to make it work? He just gave me so much to really better my relations from then on. And the thing that really stuck with me after that was how he put his life in order. How he took full responsibility for the fact that he created that he made it really clear to those children, and that he put his life in order, left me vibrating. I said, wow, wow. Well, I don't need to wait until I'm getting ready to leave my body. I'm going to put my life in order now. He gave me the strength to really look, really go to the deep stuff, really say, Jamil, what is making you happy? What is not making you happy? What are your dreams? Are you living your life? You know, what is working for you here? And be real, be real. I had seen somebody be real and really, really do it. So I had a good example that it could be done. So he got me going. Thank you so much, Richie. Then, but you never, I don't know. I don't know. Everybody has a different relationship with mother. So after Richie left in April of 2007, Juliet Nightingale, my mom, she was already not doing well at that point, but she was, you know, hanging in there. And then by 2008, I had immediately... or in 2007, immediately after Richie left, I made it happen to make a trip to Barcelona to study Spanish, which was my dream for 3 months. I took off for 3 months and I did it. And I don't recommend studying Spanish in Barcelona, but that's another story. I highly recommend Barcelona for everything. But Spanish studying, but I was following my dream. I made it happen. And then I was feeling much stronger in myself. And also in reflection, I see how that was a really important part of facing the coming up of my mother's departure. My mom and I were really, really, really close. She and I spent 27 years absolutely entwined in virtually every aspect of each other's lives. There's very little we didn't keep an eye on each other about. We were both basically orphaned from our biological family. We were basically two wounded birds that took on the world. And we stood by each other like nobody else. And really the only person that I had truly trusted in a human form. And this is something I'm learning now in my third life. I call this my third life. Now I get to learn human bonding in this life. So facing her departure was another story completely. Juliet was also a multiple near-death experiencer. From the very beginning of our relationship, within almost a half an hour, I heard about her near-death experience and how she wanted to go back to the light. She wanted to go back to the light. She did not want to be here. She was clear. She wanted to go back to this place in the sacred space that she knew in her near-death experience. And near-death experiencers out there can relate, and even, you know, universal travelers can relate. And when you've experienced a place of oneness, you can relate, because we have that to do here now on planet Earth, and we will do that here on planet Earth. That is what we are doing here right now. We are creating this oneness that near-death experiencers and you know, truly universal travelers have enlightened us about. We are bringing that now. This is what birthing into the universal consciousness is connected to. So as a young, very young person, I was in my teens when we started, I didn't really like to hear her talk about wanting to get away. I took it very personal, and I didn't really want to hear about it. So we had a lot of other things to talk about. We had a lot of other spiritual bonding experiences. She and I, we experienced so many things that are considered paranormal that I never even considered paranormal, because I never thought of it that way, because it was normal. This was life with mom, and I had no reason to not think that. I had no religious training or anything like that, and I had also some very powerful experiences as a child. And so, you know, I went into this relationship, and we had extraordinary, what are now in the common understanding, I realized would be considered extraordinary experiences. To me, they were then, and they are now normal. So it's been really interesting, because I did not come to that awareness until after she left her body. So I was a really long time in my la-la land. But forgive me. It will come in handy, I promise. Okay. So when she was getting ready to go, we both were faced with the challenge of the conversation, of the dialogue, because I had grown so much then that, and after watching Richie leave and knowing Richie is still with me and Richie, you know, paving the way, I was not afraid. I was absolutely not afraid. I knew her soul would leave and she'd be fine. So I was absolutely not afraid. What was confusing was that at the end for her, she became conflicted in herself, and she wasn't sure now that she wanted to go. And it was a lot of things going on. What I've observed that happens at end of life, and which is, I believe, also happening now here on our experience on planet Earth, is when you come to the end of a cycle, the entire cycle plays through. So whatever it is in your life that you haven't completed comes up. Everything. I saw it with Richie. I saw it with my mother. Everything. Whatever you need to complete that hasn't been completed in an end cycle, which we are in, comes up. And that is why this is part of why the intensity of this time, because we are being asked to look in ourselves and look at our incomplete business big time. This is what happened with Juliet, and Juliet had an extraordinarily painful life. Juliet's story was beyond Beyond the Beyond. And y'all here knew her as, those of you who did know her on BBS Radio, she was a radio host. She had a lovely show, Toward the Light. She had towardthelight.org. She was an adamant advocate that we unite with our divine being and to dispel the fear of death, dispel the myth of death. She was a champion for her cause. Those were the last years. She was so much more than that. And before she got to that, she had endured a tremendous amount of suffering. So her last years were bringing up a lot of things that she had not completed, a lot of cycles of really tough stuff she had to look at, she had to go through. She had to feel love in those situations. This is what I witnessed. She recreated many, many situations that I was familiar with because I knew her story. I knew where she had been. I knew the kind of people that she had hung out or been subjected to. I knew some. I didn't know all. I knew enough to recognize that these were replays. And because I had just been with Richie and watched the similar energy, I realized what was happening. Keeping up with her those last few years was a stretch, to say the least. And I learned so much. Again, now really grounding in unconditional love and no judgment, not at all, and really understanding that end-of-life process is its own animal. It has its own things to do. It's not... I think it's better to assume that every single person will do it their own way. It's not something that has a standard protocol. There are certain energetic programs or cycles that must complete, but every single person is going to have different entities in there, and every single person is going to do it a different way. So she did it her way. She had to face these things. She had to complete these things. She was really clear that she needed to face things because she was really clear that she was going to leave her body. She was complete with planet Earth, and she was really clear that she was not complete with service to humanity at this time. We had many conversations in those last days where she was telling me that she was going to go to a new form where she could be of greater service here on planet Earth. Her body was a train wreck. Her body, she was sick her whole life. She had been through cancer. Her stomach was like so many scars. I mean, this woman went through so much, so much. Her body was a train wreck. There was no way it was going to go through these energetic shifts, and she didn't want it. She was ready for a new body. We were really clear about that. So she really knew that her spirit was outgrowing the confines of this body. Again, the conversation of soul in this situation is very helpful, because when we're in conversation of soul, we first of all understand that we're all interconnected. We all understand that, you know, yeah, I'm facing the person that I have loved more than anybody leaving the body, but this is what she has to do. And at the same time, I know that I'm never going to be alone. In soul, there's no such thing as being alone. You can't ever be alone. That just isn't possible in the universe to be alone. That is just, it's completely a fictitious construct of the illusion of actually being your body. It is not possible to be alone. When you are in your soul consciousness, you understand you're connected to every living being, every living thing. Everything is a part of you, and you are a part of everything. And I was, and still am, and this has been a big part of what has helped me in my healing since being with her in this end period, because it was really traumatic facing her demise. Because here I show up. Now, I was very concerned when she took the turn, ultimately going down. I was really nervous about that. I did not want to be her primary care provider, but I was the only one there. And in the karmic structure that she was healing out, she was challenging for a lot of people because we really don't have a conversation for I need to leave now. This was the core of the challenge that I recognize now she and we faced. A lot of healers came, people were offering this and that, and she didn't want to be healed to come back in her body. She wanted to be comfortable and to be allowed to complete what she needed to complete to leave her body. She was very clear about that, but we don't have a conversation for that. We have not come up to that point yet where we can honestly say, I'm ready to go. I'm ready to go. And face that, face the death of this cycle, which is the beginning of a new cycle. Death always precedes rebirth. They're intimate. It's actually the rebirth that forces the death. I'm thoroughly convinced of this. After these two guys, yeah, I'm absolutely convinced it's the rebirth that actually creates, that insists on the death because it has to go somewhere. It's the little, you know, the seed pushing up through the old dirt. It has to move. You have to move that old cycle to get in on your new deal. You have to move that old stuff. You have to let go of the form you once knew to move in to who you are becoming. It's the universe. I didn't make it up. It's the universe. It's a pretty good plan. It works really well. But we have yet to develop a conversation for when we know it's our time that we can face each other and say, I'm done. I'm ready to go. And then there's the whole bit of the medication and the drugs and the, oh my God. I mean, I'm not somebody who's ever used allopathic medicine. I don't know anything about those drugs. Juliet had substantial history in hospitals before she and I began our sojourn. She had sworn off hospitals right before we met. Because of her big NDE, which the chemotherapy killed her, and she swore off hospitals. And so she and I never did hospitals together. Well, we faced hospitals together. We didn't go to, luckily, the hospice, I set it up at her house. But I was dealing with nurses and drugs, and she was very conflicted with the drugs, and I didn't know anything about the drugs, and I'm very concerned about her soul. I'm very concerned about her peace of mind. I'm very concerned about her being comfortable, and she's in and she's out, and she's not really with us. She's definitely processing, and it was a very, very challenging period to be steady in. And my body, because I was the one person there all the time, our bodies resonated. And I knew my body was believing that I was dying too. It was a really intense process. My body itself was shutting down. And I knew that was happening. And Juliet did not sleep. You know, they say dying people sleep. Well, not Juliet. Juliet didn't sleep the whole entire time I knew her. And the last days of her life were absolutely no exception. This kid went round the clock. And there was one time she took a 3-hour nap. It was really a beautiful experience. It was so beautiful. She had just gotten off the phone with somebody and she was at peace. It was really the one time that I saw her at peace, and she slept. Oh, it was so beautiful. I was really, wow, I was so moved by the beauty of her rest. But that was it. No sleeping, and no eating. I wasn't eating because there was, you know, sleeping and eating actually go together. You have to rest to digest. And so I lost a lot of weight. I was put myself in yoga. I did a lot of yoga. I did a lot of meditation. I made myself walk at least once a day. And I told my body, we're not dying. We're not dying. My body didn't believe me. My body was so sure because she was dying. So facing her death taught me a lot about respecting the soul process involved in the affair that has nothing to do with me. And this is really important. I find very helpful in these times because we are going through a very intense death process altogether. And it's really helpful not to judge people, not to assume for a minute that we even have a clue what they're feeling, what they're thinking, what their life story is, what brought them to this moment. We don't know. We don't know. And being with Juliet, that period really put me in that state. Even though I had hung out with this woman for how many years, right? No, forget it. I had no clue. From one day to the next, she was doing something else, and there was nothing I could do but love her, do what I could to keep her comfortable and safe. She was not bedridden, and partly by my insistence. I was very encouraging her to move while she could move. You know, I was encouraging her to use what she had while she had it. And then when it was done, she was done. So I had a hand in keeping her active. I did not have any interest in keeping her in a vegetative state. I wanted her to live fully. And I was willing to pay the price for that. And I have absolutely no regrets whatsoever. So she will have to fast forward a little. That is probably a really valuable lesson that I use now all the time. The tension rising, people are snapping, and I'm remembering you don't know what's going on with that person. We're all in a process. You don't know. And it's helping me remember all the opportunities for compassion and unconditional love that come up when I encounter people who are struggling. I'm really grateful that Mom gave me that opportunity to see that you really don't know, and you really have to just choose how you're going to respond and live with the understanding that as your soul is evolving, you are tomorrow's ancestors. And is this the story you want to leave for your children? And that's where I came to. So she left her body in a beautiful, beautiful way. It was a beautiful way. And I guess I'll go into it a little. The last moments of her life were the woman who has been, she came and stayed with us a few times, lovely Sharon. She had been with us that night, and she told us that she had a dream that the helpers came to her and told her as soon as her breathing evened out that they would cut the cord. And this was on Saturday morning, and Juliet had doing, of course, nothing usual, so we really didn't know how close she was, but she was definitely not breathing well at this point. She was sitting up, and she was hunched over and really struggling for breath. And so I went into the room after hearing this news, after doing yoga and centering myself. I went into the room, and I started breathing. Really, you know, in an exercise that I do in my meditation, I just breathe it through my feet to my heart and out through my head, and then from my head into my heart and out through my feet until it gets the whole flow, the whole breath goes through my whole body and then out. And then I sat with her, and in my energy, I transferred my breath to her, and I transferred my breathing into her body. And I felt the wave of our breathing together. We united in the breath at that last time. And I closed my eyes, and I was digging on the rhythm of that. We were really sharing this breath. And then all of a sudden, my eyes opened. I looked over, and my eyes got big. And I said, "Oh, yeah?" That came out of my mouth. And her soul came for her. Where Richie's just shot straight out, her soul came for her. This circle opened over her head, the same place, and these beautiful, like, snowflakes came down from it in this perfect rhythm. And there were like two for every cell of her body. This incredible snowflake come down, covered her entire body to her feet. And then in the perfect rhythm, as soon as they got to the feet, they were immediately began to ascend right up the same area above her head where they had come in. All these beautiful snowy, like snowflakes, just billions of them came and covered her with light and took her out. Wow. So facing death, that was part one. And this is really important because we're going to have this opportunity as we face the death of our world as we know it. You know, when we don't have money, we're going to have to really visit that over and over again because it takes a long time. It takes a while to really get that she actually left. So I sat there. I saw that. I was with her the whole time, right? There's no doubt in my mind. But for the entire month that I stayed on in her place before I left there, I kept waking up and going to her room. I kept assuming she was there. My whole body was not on the program. It didn't get that she was gone. For the entire month that I was there, I kept going and looking and kept waking up and waking up. It was three whole months before I could sleep through the night. I just kept looking and looking and listening and listening and wondering how she was. It was traumatic. That whole way it affects your body. The feelings are very, very intense. The feelings, the only way to process them that I know is to get into them. Let yourself have them. Be with it, indulge it, you know. And in that process, I met my child again. I met that little girl in me. It was my little girl that wanted to know where mom went. Where's mom? Where's mom? And it was my child. And I got to see her in an autonomous form I hadn't seen in years. And I was heartened by that, and it was a tremendous tool in where I've come to now, reconnecting with my child in a loving way, allowing my child to have that process, allowing my child to look for her again, and to love that child when she didn't find her, and to love that child when she needed to cry about that, and to love that child no matter what. Because she was gone, and this was a really big deal. You know, I never once tried to tell my child that it was not a big deal. I learned to listen to my child. I learned to listen and to honor her needs and to honor the process that she had. From that point, it was almost like there was a switching of roles. There was this point where some part of me that used to be in charge stepped back. She quit. She was out. She couldn't do the job anymore. And my child took hold. My child is pretty sharp. My child has some really good ideas. My child actually is a lot kinder and a lot more sensitive to all parties involved. My child was nobody's fool. So in this healing process, it's been exactly about that, healing the parts of me that have been fragmented in my lifetime. And then we'll fast forward to another period of letting go, of facing Juliet's demise, that she had left the planet. Was I had returned to Boston. And we won't go into the Undertaker because they really pissed me off. We're going to skip all of that. They sent me her ashes, and I took them to the beach where I now live, and I made a ceremony on the beach, and I made a hole, and I brought my toys. I have some buckets and some molds and my shovels, and I brought all my crystals, the ones that she gave me, and we had ceremony, and I felt her. I literally felt her in those ashes. And prior to that, I had assumed they were, you know, so what, ashes. But now I really don't think that. Now I really think that the body does hold resonance of the being that was in there. And those last moments, I felt like on the beach, were our quiet time. It was the time that we had the quiet of the closure that we didn't have in that whole process of those last weeks. And I was so grateful. I was so grateful that I had, you know, dealt with what I needed to have that opportunity. And it was so heartwarming to see the sea. I dug a hole and the tide had just gone out. So I had dug a hole and found water. You know how you find water pretty shallow after the water goes out to sea. And I poured her in the little hole. And then I dug a tunnel from the hole out to sea. So I saw the ashes running in the water out to sea. And it was so beautiful to just let her go into the water. And that was truly a place where I felt like, at that point, she was now gone. That was the place where I realized that she was gone. And and I still miss her. You know, the whole idea that death is nothing is really compromising an opportunity to enrich ourselves in understanding the mortal part of us, understanding the depth of our emotions. Nothing wrenches you like facing somebody you love leave. And this is just the questions that can arise. Some people will choose to seek, other people will choose to deny. It doesn't matter. It's all good. It's whatever your path is, your soul path chooses for you. It's the right thing. However you do it, it's right. There's no wrong way about this. I chose to pursue it with everything I had because I saw it for the opportunity that it presented for me to develop very deep understanding of my multidimensional being, of my multidimensional awareness, of my multidimensional connection with Juliet. She and I were always connected telepathically, always. And the day she took her last breath, that didn't change. I saw what I saw, what I shared, but our connection, our communion to this day has never, ever been interrupted. And I've had many experiences with her and her new form since. That's another conversation. But I wanted to offer these tales of my experience facing death that, as unique as they both were, they were truly experiences of the souls needing to move on to a higher place where they could continue their soul journey. There is always rebirth in the process of allowing the dying process to take its course, and to face the death is to free the new life and allow the new life to come in. This is my experience. So I want to offer that to you all. And we're at the top of the hour. Thank you for listening. Thank you very much for being a part of my evolution and for sharing in this fantastic opportunity to grow a new world. We're here to make a world we can live in, and it's such a pleasure to share the road with all of you. So I will close for now, and please do join us if you're so inclined. On the 27th of August, we'll welcome Sonia Barrett. And in the 10th of September, we'll welcome Robert Stanley. My websites will be updated in the next couple of days with more information about both of them. And I wish you all the best. Please take good care of yourselves and take good care of each other. This is Jamil Graham signing off from the Alchemy of Light broadcast. Take care.